Good morning, and welcome to the Space Game Junkie Podcast. I, as always, am your co-host, Brian, and joining me, as always, is your co-host, Jim.
Gratuitously. So,
gratuitously.
Yeah. Does that mean, like, gratuity, like we could take tips?
No.
No? Because there's a 15% gratuity to, I don't know, parties of six or more spaceships.
It's hard to be funny in the morning.
It's really hard
to be funny in the morning. And it's morning for us because our guest this week is joining us from the motherland, where America spawned from. Joining us all the way from England is developer Cliff Harris. Welcome, Cliff.
Hi there. I am indeed in England.
I just love doing that. I'm sorry.
You're lucky I am in England and not like Scotland or, you know, Ireland. I'd probably take offense if you got it wrong.
Oh, no. I made sure. No, I understand that. And I made sure to know that you're in Great Britain, in England, not the other two. Scotland almost just seceded, didn't they? Or separated or something? But it failed.
Yeah.
It didn't go through.
Yeah. It was fairly close. People thought they might, which would have been weird.
That would have been very weird because Ireland and Wales have been like, hey guys. Hi.
Yeah.
So was that actually over like controversy in games journalism?
No, we're not talking about that. We're not talking about ethics in games journalism. Actually, no.
Scotland was like, that's it, we're out. PC Gamer UK. Anyway.
It was actually a longer dispute, believe it or not, than the whole Gamergate thing.
No, they didn't go. All right, well, we have brought Cliff on to talk about the Gratuitous Space Battle series. Sadly, we couldn't get a build to stream for the second one, so we're going to stream the first one. But we're still going to talk about the second one and the first one. We'll talk about them all. So let's start from the very beginning. According to your website, Cliff, you've been making games since the late 90s? Did I read that right?
Yeah, that's true. But 1997. But yeah, that doesn't seem that long ago. I'm that old, you know, that it kind of like doesn't seem that long ago.
I guess the older you get, the younger you feel, really. I'm in my second childhood myself.
No, so. I never left my first.
Yeah.
I've been an indie since before, you know, there was indie. Really, as a thing.
Were you one of those Amstrad guys?
I had a Sinclair ZX81, which I think never really left Britain, but it had 1K of RAM.
Oh, yeah, we managed to contain that before it could escape. So,
but yeah, that was my first PC, I guess.
Yeah, for the for the amount of limitations that machine had, there's just some incredible stuff that came out of it. You know, just like whenever you look at YouTube videos and that, and I played around with an emulator for a little bit, and it seems like most of the people who in the 90s and early 2000s that were part of the British game development scene had come from those roots. You know, so they definitely knew how to optimize code for low spec.
Yeah, this is quite a big deal to me that I actually really like optimizing. I treat myself, if I've done like all of my to-do list, I'll fire up a profiler and multi-thread some stuff, which is kind of a little bit sick in some ways because most people just hate it. But I get very, very obsessed with making stuff run fast, especially lately. I overdo it, to be honest. I now can't get the game to drop below 60 frames a second, no matter what I do to it, which is good, you know. But
that's good. That's good because more and more people are complaining about that sort of thing.
Well, given the ridiculous amount of stuff that you have on the screen, that's pretty admirable that you can pull that off.
I do now. Yeah, I mean, just like looking here at GSB1, I sort of think, God, really? Does it look like that? Because the new one looks very different. To put it mildly, and also my kind of, you know, back when I did GSB1, it was kind of like a 1900 res or 1920 res monitor was huge.
That's true.
But now, like my testing setup for it is split across two monitors at 5120 by 1440 res. which is awesome.
I bet. Oh my god.
It is. It is really cool. And so my aim is to like max that out, all settings on, you know, crazy, and to still run at a smooth 60, which it does at the moment. And that's without my final pass of getting really obsessed with the optimizing.
Now, yeah,
but that's with a crazy amount of debris. Well, and
I was about to ask, one of the beauties of GSP here is that it can run on a wide variety of hardware, from low end to high end. Will GSP 2, even with all that high res stuff, will it still be able to run on a wide variety of hardware?
Yeah, it definitely will. GSP 1 was just my engine was in one thread. The sound would run like, you know, on another core, but with GSP2, I've only really tested it with four cores, but I've only got to change the number for it to be 8. And it does a fair bit of multi-threading, and I've got a fairly sort of low spec laptop that I try it on now and then, and it just runs perfectly.
Wow.
And we also showed it off at a trade show here, where I was slightly worried because the PCs weren't particularly good spec and the video cards weren't all that, but it was just fine. So I needn't have worried at all. I think if you totally mismatched your components, you know, if you had like three monitors and a like, you know, crappy laptop card plugged into them, theoretically, yeah, you could hit problems, but there's always going to be loads of options in there to turn stuff down, and it does dynamically do stuff. So it does a lot of crazy, boring programming tricks. But for example, every explosion, it will kind of like look at the headroom in the last frame to see whether or not we can have this many plumes of explosion or like slightly less plumes, you know, depending on how busy your chip is and stuff like that. I love coding stuff like that.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Crazy old guy.
Now this came out when, 2010? The first one that came out in 2010? Am I right about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, it's old now.
It kind of is, but people are still playing it. And I noticed on Steam there are people still playing it. And,
oh, yeah.
And I'm going to be honest right off the bat. I haven't played as much of it as I probably would like because I'm horrible at it. I mean, horrible. I'm so bad.
Brian? You'll be shocked to know who else is terrible at the game.
Who's that?
Klifsky.
I'm not very good at it.
What?
No, I'm not, because I'm generally not very good at games. I'm quite good at Battlefield 4. But I play games for kind of like the feeling and the emotion. So like when I play GSB, you know, I want a huge fleet and I want it to look nice. I'm not that bothered if I win or not. You know, what I want is I want the spectacle. I want to arrange the spectacle.
I think you achieved that in the first game, definitely.
No, you should see. I wish I had a build that it was like quick and easy for me to upload, or that I could stream from this kind of, you know, field that I work in, because it just, it's a whole nother world.
Well, I was looking on your blog at the video that you have of it running across, it spans two monitors, which is a new thing in this. It looks pretty cool. I mean, it's, you know, not exactly a close-up view of it, but it definitely looks much, much more eye candy than the first game, for sure.
Yeah, it's the graphics engine is completely new, really. So it's kind of in sort of faked 3D. So when you play it, it looks like all the ships are like distributed over a kind of 3D world. But they're not. So the game engine runs in 2D. So like all of your strategic decisions about formations of ships and everything like that, it's like you're playing a 2D strategy game, but it's kind of rendered in 3D-ish. So it looks like ships are above and below each other, and it looks a lot less flat than the original game. And also all of the graphics are kind of redone in a kind of fake 3D. So you have kind of proper lighting. You have lighting from a sort of a fixed direction that kind of makes sense across the sort of, it looks like all the ships are kind of bump mapped properly, and it does a hell of a lot of stuff with lighting. So like individual laser beams will kind of light up an asteroid behind them. Ooh. And stuff like this. And every single light is like a proper light. So if you have like a little kind of like flashing light on the end of an antenna of a ship that flies across another one, it will light up the ship or the rubble underneath it and crazy nonsense like that. That kind of like even the little welding arcs that come off the repair drones that repair ships, even they light up the ships underneath them. So it's all very gratuitous.
So basically, it sounds like whenever you code these things, that you're actually writing it as a challenge to your programming skill to see, you know, can I get away with that? Can I figure out how to do this?
Yeah, I am. There are a few things that can't be done. But even as I say them, I realize that there are ways I could maybe do it that would be crazy. Like there are
You're
shadows.
You're thinking about programming right now, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I do. I live and breathe it. But like the only person that will notice is me. So kind of like if a fighter flies over a ship, it casts a shadow on that ship, but the shadow isn't perfect. It's not correct. So it doesn't sort of undulate with the bump map of the ship. That could be done, but that would be hell. And there's a lot of things that kind of like, you know, it could look much better, but I want it to run at 60 frames per second and look as good as it can. So there's a constant trade-off with that. And to be honest, like with GSB1, I made a decision that I kind of like can't go back on that makes life hell, in that you can slow the game down and you can freeze frame and then move the camera, which means you can't cheat. So you can't have like these little glitches that the player will never notice, because they can actually freeze frame and then zoom in and go, aha, you know, that's not being rendered properly. So it all does have to be perfect in like maximum zoom freeze frame, which massively adds to the challenge of doing it.
Well, even the first game had lots of details if you zoom in. I mean, the turrets move and you can see the hull, you know, taking damage and little fires here and there. And yeah, see, I'm losing terribly. I'm losing horribly.
It's funny because the whole like damage texture thing is something that has bugged me for a long time, and I only fixed it a few days ago, in that all of the sparks that come off the like the damaged bits of ships, they like come off that ship, and that's fine. They're drawn on top of the ship. Whereas now I have some that are kind of composited with an outline of the damage, so it looks like they're actually inside the ship and burning.
Oh.
Which kind of makes it again seem a lot more 3D and a lot more kind of wow. And it has bloom as well, and it has those crazy lens flares that JJ Abrams loves. And you know, it's only because of like legal reasons that I don't want a setting in there that just says JJ Abrams, because I would love that.
You know, what I want to do,
amazing.
I want to take,
just call it JJ. Sorry, Jim. Go ahead. Just call it JJ.
Yeah.
I want to take Cliff and Mike to pull and lock them in a room until they come out with some hybrid of gratuitous enemy starfighter, and you know, where you can actually fly around in one of these battles while
That'd
it's going
amazing.
On at gratuitous scale. Oh yeah. So if you want to stop by, I'll see if I can have both of them visit me at the same time, and I'll lock them in the basement.
So where did the idea for GSB-1 come from? I think I remember reading a while back that had something to do with Battlestar Galactica.
No.
Okay.
No. It's got a really weird origin. It was when I started coding it, it was like a dictator simulation. It was kind of like a virtual Saddam Hussein game, which probably doesn't make any sense at all. But the inspiration for it as a game is kind of the Total War games. I know none of this seems to make any sense, does it? Combined with a book I read about D-Day. I have strange influences for games. I quite like the Total War games in theory, but I really don't like them, even though I buy all of them, because I feel like I have no control. So I love the huge battles. So I'll set up some huge army with massive you know, huge array of troops, and I'll put them into position, and then the battle will start. And maybe I just suck at the games, but I just feel like it all descends into big, some sort of big barroom brawl where I have no pretense of control during the battle. And I find that massively frustrating. So I was reading this book about D-Day, and it kind of explained how, like, the Allied commanders in the field were given a lot of freedom to, like, wing it on the day, whereas the German army was not. It was very much directly controlled from the top. And some historians consider that this is one of the reasons that D-Day worked, because they were more flexible. So reading that and thinking about how strategy games seem to give me a feeling of powerlessness during the battle, what I wanted to do was to design a game where that was the key mechanic.
Oh.
So there was no pretense that you had any control. So there was no feeling of frustration that it was down to your inability to click. Also, because, like, you know, I'm in my 40s and I can't do 600 actions per minute or whatever it is. That's like the StarCraft, click, 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 click. And I think, you know, that's, to me, that's an arcade game. That's not a strategy game. So what I wanted is I wanted a game with millions of units and thousands of things blowing up. But I wanted some feeling that I wasn't just going to get beaten at it by some 12-year-old kid because he could click faster. So I deliberately had this mechanic of how about a game where it's all about setting it up. It's all about, like, that Napoleon thing where you make your plan before the day of the battle, and that's how you win. And also, when I've noticed watching other people play games, and when I play strategy games, I like the designing of the units and the positioning of the troops. I kind of get a buzz out of, you know, setting up the army beforehand. So I wanted that to. I wanted there to be a game that I'd like.
Do you have in your background? Do you have a bit of tabletop wargaming?
A little bit. I mean, you were really going back now. Yeah, to some extent. And I get the impression that GSB does appeal to a lot of, like, sort of tabletop wargamers.
Mm. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. So what did you play? Was it like Firefly or Napoleonic stuff or what?
Oh, God, I mean, this is going so, you know, so far back. A game I got very obsessed with, actually, which probably makes a lot more sense, was Starfleet Command. Starfleet Battles, isn't it?
Right.
Starfleet Command was the PC version.
Mm.
I got very obsessed with that, and it's crazily complicated rules.
Yeah, well, I love Federation Commander, which is sort of a reboot of that. Because I had a friend that I never owned Starfleet Battles, but I played it with a buddy of mine that had a binder. It's probably like the thickest binder that you can get. It's like a 6-inch tall thing, and it was all the books that he had in there. It's like, how do you find a rule? Because everything in that game was. It was like politics. It's like you have to know the exceptions to the rule and try to, you know, if you can game it to the letter of the – so
– It's absolutely incredible game. It's a game for – I think it's a game for, like, retired engineers with far too much time on their hands.
Yeah.
But it does kind of appeal to – I've got all the, like, you know, expansions for everything.
Mm.
And I did kind of love it. But the only problem is if you want to fight a battle, it's going to take you at least a weekend.
Right.
Because a single turn. Yeah, a single turn could be 3 hours.
Yeah, I've done that at conventions before. You know, I'll go in and I'll sign up. You know, it's like a Friday, Saturday, Sunday wargaming convention. I'll show up on Friday and I'll sign up for the Starfleet Battles thing. And then I'm still there Sunday afternoon. We're not done.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, people are like sleeping under the table and yeah.
Oh, yeah. God.
So
it's kind of intense. And you only need one person to sneeze and, like, you know, all things gone, you know. Yeah, it's pretty intense.
Well, the computer game version of that Taldron made was it Starfleet Command?
That was Starfleet Command.
So I love that game. I wish that somebody would kind of go back into that, because it took everything that was visceral about Starfleet Battles and then stuck it into something that was approachable and you could play it in real time and that. So it's pretty neat.
Yeah, I really like that. I thought that was pretty good. I mean, what I really, you know, my dream game, which I'm hoping GSB 2 kind of is kind of that kind of complexity and the options for true strategy rather than just frantic clicking. You know, that combined with, you know, the sort of like modern space battle like aesthetic of like Ender's Game and stuff like that, where it's completely over the top. I mean, basically for the user interface for GSB2, I kind of emailed the art guy who does my GUI and just said, you know, I kind of want Ender's Game, but like more so. And like, just go nuts and don't worry about it. I'll find a way to make it work in the game. Which he did, and I've done that, but I still feel like I want to put more in. I want it to be more stupid and kind of animated and like that whole that whole crazy GUI that, you know, when you see in a movie, you go, whoa, that would never work in real life. I love that.
Yeah, and you should lie and say, oh yeah, we got Oculus Rift support. And you know, so
I've never tried. I haven't actually tried the Rift. I've tried another Oculus thing, but I've tried Valve's VR thing. And I remember always thinking, "Oh God, I hope VR doesn't take off because it's not for me." You know, I don't even do proper 3D, let alone. And then I tried the Valve VR thing, and it was amazing. And I thought, "Oh God, you know, I need to do like a sort of Ender's Game style GSB in proper 3D, waving your arms about, and it'd just be awesome."
Well, even if it wasn't 3D, you could still have the battle take place in a like you're inside a sphere and it's just projected on the walls. So, you know,
yeah,
the 360.
I
wanted to ask you about Positec and what all goes on there, because I was looking at the company site and I didn't realize like Democracy 3 and Redshirt also came from you guys. So is that you that made that, or you have additional people, or how many people is Positec?
It's just me. it's mad. It's the only person doing programming is me. Redshirt was pretty much done by another company, which is a one-man company. That's me too. And I was the publisher. So I kind of funded it and did the kind of marketing business side of it.
Oh, okay.
But all the other games, like, the Democracy games, they're all coded and everything's done by me. I don't do art anymore. I do the occasional little tiny bit.
So as a British person, you have a fantastic grasp on the insanity of American politics. So I don't know. did you just spend time in an asylum for a while to kind of do like a character study of how our politics works?
I've watched every episode of The West Wing. Does that count?
Okay, there it is.
That totally counts.
Because I look to that game as an educational simulator, because whenever people were talking in the last, the last election cycle, and they're like, well, this guy, you know, and he comes in here and he doesn't do what he said he'd do and the stuff. Mm. And I was just like, here, go play Democracy 3 and then come back to me and explain to me why that your candidate has to kind of be all over the map and all things to all people and a lot of BS.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that game is, it's not really meant to be cynical. It's not.
I found that it was scarily realistic, actually, because it took all political aspirations like right out of me. I was just like, nope, I'm done. I'll never think about even being mayor.
Well, it kind of does do that to you. It's what I mean, it was done as a kind of intellectual exercise. And what I wanted is as accurate as I could make a simulation of politics and economics without any agenda or any particular point of view. Mm-hmm. And I get a lot of hassle from people saying that it's my own prejudices are in there. And it's which is fascinating, because they kind of were in the first game almost by accident, because I hadn't kind of worked out a decent way to simulate the private provision of stuff that is sometimes publicly provided. So like in the UK, we have state healthcare, and there wasn't a very good representation of private provision of healthcare. So it was kind of slightly biased towards a like big state thing. But only because of my own inability to code it. It was supposed to be kind of like completely neutral. And I think that the third one is the most neutral it's got. And it tries to be, you know, totally and utterly a neutral simulation of anything that you want to do. But I do get hassle from some people saying that clearly it's all a communist plot by me to,
well,
you know,
well, if you get both the left and the right bitching, yeah, then you know you're in the middle. So
yeah, I do, exactly. I mean, this is what I think, you know, because I get a bit of that, and also I get a bit of grief from the other side as well.
Now I have a suggestion, because I didn't realize that it was you that made this thing, but now that I do, I have to really lean into this. What we need is Democracy 3 in space, right? Because nobody has done good politics in a like a Master of Orion 4X, right? You have that political thing that comes up, and it's just like, oh yes, we will trade you the map, you know, or whatever. Please don't shoot us. But there's to take something like Democracy and then spin that into, okay, I'm actually the governor of some colonies or something, you know, where you have a space element to it, and that would open it up to the whole sci-fi audience. And honestly, if you had it almost like a Crusader Kings sort of thing, then you could get away with doing Frank Herbert's Dune in space as a political simulation.
Yeah, this is true. I mean, I would love to see someone, you know, like do a mod of it. It's a very easy game to mod. You can kind of tear the whole thing apart and put it back together just with spreadsheets and stuff. You don't need it's kind of like the game you can mod with Excel. You really can, you know, it's CSV files mostly and some text files. And I would, you know, I would really encourage and love to see someone really go mad on that. You know, I'd love to like fund that. I'd love to have that made. I just literally can't do all of the games that I want to do because, you know, the bottleneck is me as a coder. And I'm far too obsessive a coder to like hand programming to anyone else.
Mm. So what brought you back to Gratuitous Space Battles instead of going into something else? Because you did Gratuitous Space Battles and then you did the Tank Battles, which I have to admit I've not played because I was so terrible at the space one. It was
it's very different. It's a tower defense game. Everyone assumes it's DSB with tanks, but it isn't. It's a tower defense. It's a very experimental tower defense game in that you can play attack or defense, and you can you can play attack and then you can play defense against the attack that you just launched. So it does some kind of like interesting things, I thought. But what I didn't realize is that people that like tower defense games, they don't want that. It also has like an adaptive attack for you to defend against. And actually, it seems that people that like tower defense games, they just want to know the script. They want to learn the script of what's coming and win against it. So all of my innovations that I thought were kind of like fixing the problems with tower defense turn out to be exactly what tower defense players don't want.
Well, congratulations on your success.
It still sold. It still did well, you know. So why did I come back to GSB? Basically, I thought I could do it again, but so much better. You know, if I just thought, oh, I'll do another GSB game, then I wouldn't do it. The reason I do like multiple versions of a game is when I look at, like when I'm watching here and I think, no, this is not what it should look like. And it looks nothing like this now. It looks so much richer and better. And the user interface is so much better. The explosions are just better. The ships are better. Just everything about it is like transformed. And, you know, to be honest, I'm a much better programmer and a much more experienced programmer than I was when I made GSB1. So I wanted to, I still love the idea, and I wanted to sort of really seriously do the idea justice. And also, like, you know, if you can code anything, then coding spaceships blowing up is kind of cool.
There's not a damn thing wrong with spaceships blowing up.
Absolutely.
You know. Now, this game had, what, six expansions? Five, six expansions, including...
I think it was about 100, wasn't it?
80 billion... 11 billion. 11 billion expansions.
Yeah, I got a little bit of flack from that from some people, but it was always from people that that didn't play it and never bought it. Saying, oh, you're doing another expansion, you're kind of milking it and all this. And I thought, look...
What right do they have to say anything? They haven't bought it.
Yeah, I mean, you know... They all sold really well. They were all really popular. The campaign expansion was massively popular.
I suck at that too.
I did quite like that. It wasn't like a full on Forex game.
Yeah.
But it changed the game a lot, I thought, because in GSB, like, the whole thing is you have this huge fleet and 300 cruisers get blown up and you think, whoa, cool. But in the context of the campaign game, you sort of think, no, you know, it took me so long to build that up. So, the whole concept of like retreating or capturing enemy ships was kind of good fun. That was very popular, the campaign thing. But they were all really popular. And, you know, if I was just like doing it to sell games and make money, then I could, I could have done another five or six expansions for that game and they would easily... you know, find an audience. But I just thought it would, I had so many ideas that I couldn't do with that same engine that I just thought, no, it's time to start again and kind of reimagine the whole thing.
Well, let me ask you something, because I played this when it first came out and I was so bad at it. I honestly shelved it for a while because I'm like, I'm tired of losing. Oh my God. And I came back a while later and I noticed that direct ship control was added. When was that added and why? Because I thought at first I thought the whole point of the game was to put these ships together and like, oh crap, my plan failed, I have to watch it fail. But then you add control and that kind of throws that a little bit on its head. So I was wondering what the impetus was to add direct control. And I also was curious as to how hard that was to add.
Well, this is the thing. It took about 2 weeks. And that's with like testing it, because it's that aspect of it is actually really easy in programming terms. It's almost all user interface. In fact, it makes it a lot easier because if you're telling the ships where to go or who to shoot at, then you know you're offloading that AI to the player. So it's actually, you know, it's actually very easy. I put it in mostly because there were, you know, in reviews of the game, occasionally you'd have people say, oh, that sucks. You know, I don't want to play a game where I can't control the ships. And I thought, you know, you're kind of missing the point. But I thought, look, if I put it in as an option and it's, but like you don't get points for it. Like if you beat a challenge using that, you know, that doesn't get ranked up as like you having beaten it. And you couldn't do it in the campaign, as I recall. So it was just kind of like, because it was so easy to put in and because quite a few people had said, you know, it would be so cool if, I thought, well, hey, you know, the next time I patch the game, I am going to put that in. And it was quite easy and hardly anyone used it. it was kind of ignored, which I thought was interesting because it kind of reinforced what I thought originally, that like the idea of hands-off battles is a good one, and that works. And when given the option with that same game, people aren't racing towards it. You know, no, I didn't have a, like everyone going, "Wow, this is so cool! It's so much better," which is kind of what I thought. And it looks like I'm, you know, that won't be an option in GSB2. I'm sort of going back to the core thing of no, it's completely hands off.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, because I find that, I mean, this game gives me a bit of anxiety.
it's supposed not to.
Well, it does, because I'm like, oh god,
Brian,
I hope it works.
Brian
I hope it
can't
works.
Sit and watch an aquarium without breaking a sweat. You know,
I do have an anxiety issue. I will admit that, but some games give me more anxiety than others, and this is definitely a game that, even with full control, gives me some anxiety.
but why is that? That's interesting. Is it kind of like the feeling that you're powerless?
Well, that's part of it, but it's also like, oh god, all those guys on those ships are dying. It's my fault. Oh, I'm a terrible admiral.
That brings up
horrible.
What I need in Gratuitous Space Battles 2 is to actually be able to zoom in, and when a ship takes a hit, I want to see like the little people get sucked out into space and kind of flail their arms and,
that's cold.
And look at you and say, "You bastard." So, yeah, you know, just to stress Brian out.
Well, I mean, you have the escape pods that fly out when a big ship is destroyed. And it is on my to-do list that to have a system, a little AI routine in there that kind of, if right now I can't hit anything and, you know, I'm not kind of like saving my ammo or anything, and if there's an enemy escape pod, maybe I should zap that. That involves a bit more work than you'd think, because they're not technically ships in the code. But I think that would be cool. It's always one of the things that is in GSB1, and this is the sort of thing that there's lots of in GSB2, is it does this headroom thing whereas it kind of like analyzes how much time is left before the end of the frame. And if it's got some spare time and there's asteroids and there's like not asteroids, debris floating about, occasionally you'll shoot some and it will blow up. And I love stuff like that, like the little tiny things that you zoom in and kind of think, you know, surely they're not colliding each bullet against each little bit of debris or asteroid. And, you know, I like to kind of like trick the player into thinking, yeah, he is. it's all being calculated. So I would love to have a little system that every now and then you see an escape pod float off and it just gets zapped by one of the enemy.
So I had an idea thinking about that, because with the enemy, you know, shooting that. And then I thought, well, what if there was a faction that actually went around and scooped up the escape pods and then turned them into their own troops? But then I thought, what about the Borg, right? If you had a race in there that would actually capture enemy ships and like start converting them into their own, and just turn them around and start shooting.
Yeah. There's a few tiny sort of nudges in that direction in the game, but it hasn't been done fully fledged. There's a weapon in GSB1 and in 2 that when a missile is coming in, it kind of scrambles it, but it's called the return to sender beam. So it scrambles it and sends the missile back to hit whoever launched it, which I quite like. And in GSB2, there's a tractor beam that shakes the enemy ship slightly until it falls to pieces, which is slightly inspired by the whole kind of like Borg thing. And something that I really want in is that thing that the Borg like lasers do, and that lasers do generally in Star Trek, where they like carve a line across a ship, where they're kind of like cutting into it. I would love to do that, but it's a bit of a coding challenge, because you have to make sure there's no gaps.
Well, the ships are made out of modular pieces now, right, that you click together like Legos. So could you slice those pieces off and just have them adrift?
Some, without going into tedious detail,
excuse me.
Some you can. It would be possible to do that. This is the sort of thing that I would love to like just take a month off and like, you know, code that and make that possible. When a ship blows up now, it doesn't break into just predefined bits and some debris like it does in the original game. It will do that, but also each individual component that you've put on will also break into individual bits. So if you stick on, you know, some great big engines somewhere, as the ship breaks apart, those engines will all separately sort of drift away and catch fire and stuff like that. That's been great fun, coding all that.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty much what I was after.
Mm. But what I don't have is you can't blow off a piece of the ship and while it's still intact, unfortunately. But I'd love to code that. You know, I mean, how cool would that be? You know, that I do love things like that. Or I like the idea of like a ship being damaged, losing some of the lights, because there's proper lighting now. So you can like dim everything and have a battle that is just lit by the beam lasers, which is great. And it would be cool. I still have a to-do list note that a ship that takes heavy damage, all of its light should blink slightly. That's on my I've got loads of stupid things like that on my to-do list.
I'm surprised you ever get a game done, because once you get it to the point where you can sit and just look at it, I would just get hypnotized by it and, you know, forget to finish it.
Yeah, well, there's always things when you look at it, you're always sort of thinking, you know, I need to fix that, or, you know, or was that slightly slow? Should I change that? I find it quite difficult to sit and play any game that I've worked on for too long without wanting to sort of dive into the code and add stuff and change stuff and improve stuff. Because you have complete, you know, as the coder, you have complete control. If you're the coder and the designer and company owner, you can do anything you want. Nobody will sort of say, no, that's silly. You know, you don't want to waste time putting that in. Like, I'm just looking at this stream now and seeing like all those tiny little ships flying between one planet and another along the sort of warp things. And, you know, that's completely pointless. But, you know, I remember taking the time to do that. And I remember taking the time to optimize that as well. It's kind of crazy.
I like it. It adds some flavor. Like, this is a busy planet.
Yeah. It takes me back looking at this. It seems a long time ago now. And yeah, in fact, there's little satellites orbiting. I'd forgotten I'd even put them in.
Yeah, I just noticed that myself. So I just lost my first battle. I had to retreat because, God damn it, Cliff. Son of a bitch. Why can't I win? Why can't I do anything? No.
You have to carefully pick your battles in the campaign. There are certain places that only have so many that you can kind of hole up in. You know, you can kind of like, it's kind of like playing Risk, where there's, you know, certain places like Australia and what have you that have limited points to defend. So all the campaign maps are kind of designed to give you quite a few of these that you can kind of, you know, like where you're going now, if you can get that planet, you're safe there, you know.
Yeah, I'm retreating. I'm seeing these bigger ships. They're surrounded by what look like rocks or something. And yeah, I'm getting the hell out.
See, what I like about that is someone else has designed those ships. You know, not me, not the AI. Some other player of GSB, whether they're playing the campaign or not, at some point they've designed that arrangement of ships.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Every battle you play in the campaign, because every now and then when you're playing the campaign, it will take your fleet and upload it, and it will kind of analyze the fleet for kind of like how good it is and what race it's made up of. And then every time you play the campaign, it has a kind of a slight sort of like auto-adjusting difficulty. So when you send your ships in, it will go, you know, what fleets do we have that will be of a reasonable size given what the AI should have and are of the correct race? And it will pick one and download it. So, yeah, someone's designed that. And right now, you know, there's probably someone playing against that fleet that you just sent in there. Even though you didn't fire a shot, it will still be analyzed online.
That's kind of fascinating.
That's the kind of like the Spore thing, which was quite achievable to code. I was quite surprised. I would love to have that sort of system with a campaign rather than just the challenges for GSB2, because then obviously you're going to see the visuals you'll never have seen before. So you'll see ships completely designed by other people. Maybe some of them will suck, but hopefully some of them will, and they'll be rude shapes, you know, but hopefully some of them will look really amazing.
Yeah. So there's just a ton of gameplay here. Now, will the second game have a campaign like this, or is that going to be another add-on for it later?
Well, to see, I hate to say it would be another add-on, because I don't like the idea that the minute you say something like that, people are like, oh, it should have been in the base game. And I think, Jesus, man, it's only me.
I think it's completely understandable that, you know, you're one, especially since you're, like you just said, one person, that, like, yeah, you do what you can, you ship a product that's, like, the foundation. You know, it's a good game, it's a foundation, then you build on top of it. That makes sense to me.
I mean, you know, I don't know if there will ever be a campaign. I wouldn't want to do a campaign for it that was anything less than this GSB1 campaign, which I quite like, but it could have been bigger and better and more in depth.
Right.
But so I don't know. I don't like to commit to it. And to be honest, GSB2 would just never have happened if I'd had to, you know, incorporate all of this at launch, because there's so much work involved in the rest of it. That it would just not have, it's not just a matter of me like re-enabling set campaign equal true, you know, and then it'll all work. It won't. not vaguely, not in a million years. So it would have to, it would take a lot of work. So I would like to do it, but I'd, you know, I don't know. And there is a part of me that would like to take a proper like year and a half and then just do it all again from scratch, but better. So who knows?
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, I guess the one thing with the AI in this game, there it's each ship basically works as an independent actor, right? So you can't say this is the command ship and these guys get orders from that ship, but they all just kind of do their own thing based on what priorities you give them, right?
Well, you can set up formation orders. And you can give escort orders. So you can basically, with an escort order, you're saying stick within this range of this ship. Mm. So don't leave that range. Other than that, obey your orders. And there was a formation order in GSB-1 which basically said stick at this offset from that ship at all times. Mm. Now, the problem with that is if that ship gets destroyed, then suddenly you're cut loose. And actually, a lot of people who got really into the game and designing their fleets and their challenges, they use that as a, that kind of flaw in the gameplay, as it were. They use that deliberately as a mechanic, whereas they'd have like a time-released wave of ships that would be super fast, but they'd be formation-slaved to like a really weak, slow ship that they knew would draw fire. And then when it was destroyed, that would release these ships to fly out as a deliberate flanking maneuver, which I think was kind of cool. But in the new game, in GSB2, I've kind of changed the way formations work. So you can just like loop select an entire group of ships and say stick in formation, and they will dynamically elect the biggest ship as a commander, and all try and stay in formation relative to each other. You have much more robust formations. So there's going to be a lot less of the kind of like random flailing around and a lot more of the kind of organized formation battles.
All right.
Yeah, but do you simulate morale at all? Like if a side starts losing or a ship gets damaged enough, it'll just turn and run?
There is an order that you can give, which I can't remember the name of it, but there is an order that you can give that basically says once you take this much hull damage, retreat to where you came in from. And if you have repair modules, then your ship will repair, you know, like behind the lines, as it were, and then come back. And in GSB2, there's this new thing that you have a lot of modules that will kind of reinforce other ships remotely so they can, like, project better shields and stuff like that. So there's a lot more scope for ships kind of recovering in GSB2 than there was in GSB1.
Okay. So the interplay of the ships, like, could I make a ship that heals another ship, or it's a support vessel?
That is on my to-do list. I don't think I've done that yet, but most of the mechanics for it are kind of already... I'm actually looking at the code right now because I'm that pathetically hardcore that obviously the code is still open even while I'm talking to you. Yeah, I don't have that yet. What I have is thrust and shields and tracking, but I am going to have repair.
Yeah, because I was just thinking about like whenever I've played EVE Online, right? So you can you can play a ship that is just a support ship, so you keep it behind the big ship and you just continue to pump shields into that guy. And it becomes a strategy of, well, I need to kill off all the support ships before I can really damage the big one.
Yeah.
So
that's quite a big thing that is definitely going into the new version, because there's new classes of ship. There's a gunship, which is basically a bigger fighter. And there's a dreadnought, which is just stupidly big. and people modded in dreadnoughts, and they were like, you must have dreadnoughts. And I thought, yeah, that'd be kind of awesome. But there's also destroyers, and the destroyers basically have all of the support modules. So you're going to stick your destroyers next to your cruisers and your dreadnoughts. So they're the only class of ship that have these shield support beams and these tracking support beams. Mm. And that also have a lot of the kind of missile defense stuff. So all of the modules that kind of shoot down incoming missiles, they're going to be on destroyers. So you would have that kind of screen of kind of like protecting ships around the big, you know, cruisers.
Oh, neat. So it sounds like this could turn into like a hands-off harpoon in space, if you like deploy out like a battle group in a particular formation, and then you know put your picket ships out, and I can see a lot.
That's something that I really want. What I want is I want people to have these sort of like grand formations of kind of like, you know, they've got their two dreadnoughts, whatever, and they're half a dozen cruisers, loads of destroyers protecting them. And then they've got like a screen of frigates out the front and fighters that go off to like harass the enemy. You know, that's what I want. I want formations that look cool. What I want is I want game mechanics, and I think I do have them, that kind of encourage the player to naturally design a battle that looks cool. That's kind of my aim.
So one other thing I wanted to ask you, and I know Brian's got to get to work, so we're kind of running short on time. But as
you got
a
vote,
as a oh yeah, you got to vote for me. So
it's election day here in America.
So as a one-man company, challenges do you face as far as getting your game distributed and into online storefronts and just consumer awareness of it? And that, I mean, at this point you're established, right? So you've already got all your contacts and your go-to people, and it happens, right? You just make the game and it goes. But coming into this, you know, what was your struggle, and what did you have to learn? Because there's a whole lot more that I'm finding myself now, that there's a whole lot more to the game business than actually just making the game.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, maybe half of it is making the game. It really is. This is what a lot of people don't realize. Because like I published a game by someone else, Redshirt, and I'm actually funding and publishing another game, a strategy game about the pharmaceutical industry called Big Pharma. So this is kind of like something. I do this in my spare time, haha. This is kind of like something that I do for people because I know it is really very difficult. It's very difficult to get noticed and to get any press. But it's also a bit of a minefield, because if you're like a new developer and like a small indie developer, you don't know what things should cost. You don't know what should be in a contract and what shouldn't. And some of the contracts are bad, and some of them are great. And you don't know what is a sensible rate for advertising or for sending out a press release or you know, all of this kind of like admin stuff. And you don't realize that some places you have to chase for your money or they just won't pay. There's a lot of things like that. And it is incredibly difficult, because if you are on your own, you have to be maybe 33% business, 33% marketing, and 33% making a game, you know, of which maybe 20% max is programming. And then you have to be a really, really good programmer to get anywhere with a decent game. So it's crushingly difficult. And it's only because I've been coding for 34 years and I've been an indie developer since 1997. That I can manage it as a like team of one. But it's very unusual now to have one person.
So what
it's
would
normally like three or four.
So what would your advice be? Let's say I'm a one man show and I've just made this game. And now I want to actually get it up for sale somewhere. But I don't even know how to get media attention or anything beyond having a Twitter account and just kind of yelling at the world like, hey, I've got a game.
There is a way around it. The way around it, crushingly, depressingly, is money, because you have to have a marketing budget and spend money on advertising and hire like a PR company and stuff like that. And this is the difficult thing, because initially, like, you don't have any money.
Mm-hmm. So what is the PR company's function, though? Because I've just gone through an exercise myself, because I'm helping somebody try to overcome this, and that's why it's on my mind today, where I spent all last week trying to discover what email addresses do I actually send this press release to, You know, it's like, we've got a great press release. I have nobody to send it to. What do I do?
Yeah.
And what I'm finding out,
that's a big part of it.
I called a buddy of mine who actually works for a PR agency.
Right.
And he said, initially, as an indie person, and especially like if you're doing an early access release or a green light or something like that, that you want to one-on-one engage just person to person with the people that have the indie sites and stuff like that, and don't really put the money into, you know, coming to a, you know, like, don't come to a PR firm like me yet, right? Because we'll take your money and we're not going to achieve anything that you couldn't on your own. But once you get to the point where you want really wide coverage and somebody to pay attention, then it helps to have a PR firm. Because when they see an email come in from a known PR firm, that's different than just Joe, nobody on the street sent us a press release.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it kind of really, really depends what your limiting factor is. I mean, for me, the limiting factor is always time, because I'm coding a phenomenally complicated game and doing all this sort of like businessy marketing stuff. So for me, anything that saves me time, even if it's something I could do myself, like sending out press releases and stuff, then I would pick that. But like, if you're a new indie, if you have a lot of time and no money, then you should absolutely spend a huge amount of time finding the journalists that cover the kind of stuff that you're making, and you know, getting in contact with the right people and being kind of like Mr. Social Networking, which a lot of them do.
So basically, with a PR firm, you're paying for their expertise in already having a social network.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they know who to email, and you can find out who to email, but it takes time. And also, it takes a lot of time to do that thing where you go around to all the trade shows and the conferences, stuff like that, which I do a little bit now, but I never used to do. I mean, when I made Gratuitous Space Battles, when that was released, I'd never been to a game show outside of the UK, and I'd never exhibited at one ever.
Do those really help, though? Is it like the press is there to see who's bringing stuff? So is it almost – because like E3, whenever I went to that, there's a little bit of press. There's a lot of press, but the ratio of press versus distributor to publisher business dealings back when I went was a whole lot more weight on, hey, let's have backroom meetings where we talk about how many copies of this Walmart's going to buy versus, hey, we want to show the game to PC Gamer. All right. So,
yeah. Well, you're kind of there. I've done one show with GSP too, and I'm going to do another one in the UK. I may try and do one in the US, I don't know, but you're kind of only slightly there for like the big name press. You're more there for kind of like the really enthusiastic members of the public who are kind of like mini press, in that they may not even have a blog, but you know, they are active on God knows how many forums, and they tweet a lot, and you know, they will upvote stuff on Reddit a lot, and you kind of want to get your game in front of like the real hardcore gamer who is kind of like worth, you know, in terms of PR and name recognition, you know, a dozen kind of ordinary gamers, because you're a pretty hardcore gamer if you like, you know, travel and then queue up and pay money to get in to see a game that will be out next month anyway. it's for the people who really do follow stuff and who are kind of like the evangelists. So yeah, it's cool if like press show up and like some people videoed GSB2 and interviewed me and stuff for this show, but also you get a huge number of people that just sit down and play it, and they won't say anything to you, but all that will happen is that they will say, hey, I played that game, like, you know, when it was still in development, and it looks awesome and blah blah. So they're kind of like the vocal kind of foot soldiers for getting the word out about your game.
So the
shows are expensive. It's an expensive business to do. Indies forget this. They say, oh well, you know, we'll show our game at PAX or whatever this, and you think, do you know how much a booth costs? Do you know? Yeah. And like, if you don't live in the States, it's a whole nother world of like, you know, intercontinental flights and stuff. It's an expensive business to do that.
Right. So speaking of expensive, and we were talking about like a, like say a single man shop, and they want to they say, okay, I don't have time for this, so I do want to hire somebody in PR, but I've never done it. How much should I pay, and how do I know that I can trust these people? You know, do I look at like their portfolio of other customers and how they treated them? How do I assign a dollar amount to that?
Yeah, it's very hard. I mean, one thing is that a lot of like PR, I've only used one PR agency, to be honest. Although I've spoken to some others, I think most of the PR agencies that would even talk to an indie have this thing that they'll kind of work with whatever budget you've got, as long as it's not like $10, you know. So, you know, they'll just devote more time to you depending on, you know, how much you're paying. So they can be pretty flexible. But my general rule now is that people should probably, I would say, look at spending the same on marketing the game as you did developing it.
Yeah.
Which is kind of depressing to some people because they're very idealistic and they're kind of like, no, man, I can just tweet and, you know, my followers will whatever. And it really doesn't work in this age of like, you know, Call of Duty Super Bowl ads. You know, you have to get the word out.
Yeah, that's a very interesting number, right? So it's basically if it costs me $100,000 to make it, then I better spend $100,000 to actually get exposure. Mm. So
I mean, you can do it depends what you're including in that figure, because most people don't include their own time. And to be honest, I don't include my own time.
Oh, because the stuff that I've encountered, just, you know, advice to other indie devs that are listening, there's a website called Pixel Prospector, and they connect a lot of the dots. They have a couple of sites that actually list, you know, like here's all the game review sites, right? And they don't hit them all, but they did pretty good. They don't have the contact info for them, but they've got like all their Twitter accounts and stuff. So I still had to do the legwork to go to each one and try to find the about us and the here's how to email the editor and all that. And I had the advantage of kind of being on the receiving end of the press release stuff. So I know how it comes in.
Yeah.
And the chain of, you know, the editor gets it, he passes it to this guy, and then it comes to me. So from the receiving side, I kind of knew how to target things. But to just be somebody that's a programmer and it's just like, well, here's a list of websites, go for it. You know. But they get into a lot of things about, you know, how to have a press kit, how to promote, what to have on your website that people are going to need to see, things like that. And when Brian and I talk to Kickstarter people, we always tell them, like, maximum engagement, update the damn Kickstarter every day. Show that you're present. And that kind of thing. So what I'm doing is kind of through this experiment that I got involved with helping another game out, and it's mostly for my own benefit, because I just want to learn how that works. And once I build the knowledge of that, and then I can take the knowledge that I have of some other stuff, and like social media engagement and that, and then Brian has the SEO experience, right? And then I've got a buddy that's an SEO guy as well. So what I would like to do is bring a lot of this knowledge together and just have a like a kit that when we have an indie dev on and they're like, well, we don't know how to solve this problem, I can just drop this kit on them and say, there it is. You know, this is the best that we could possibly give you for launching.
I mean, I have to say that because I get games pitched to me now and then, because I, you know, I'm publishing my second one, and I'll probably do more. And I invest in some others. A lot of games are just doomed before they've even thought about marketing, because the actual game idea is just not of interest. You know, not just to me, but just like not to the press. Like, you know, if I get an email saying, you know, we're doing a roguelike game, and you know, we love roguelike games, and it's really cool, and here's some screenshots, then I sort of think, well, what's the point? You know, there's loads. You have to say immediately why it isn't just a roguelike, you know. And I know a guy that did the game Crypt of the Necrodancer.
Oh, which is a, I love that game.
That's a rhythm-based Necrodancer, rhythm-based roguelike. And
tell him to go screw himself, because I suck at that game too. That game is balls hard.
I told Brian I would buy him a dance mat if he would put a webcam on himself playing it. It would be worth the expense.
That's such a good idea.
I love that you can do that. That's amazing that you can actually do that.
But it's, you know, I mean, immediately, like in the one sentence, you know, he when he says, I'm doing a rhythm-based roguelike, you're like, hang on, what? And it's suddenly interesting. So, like, I mean, you know, to take the two games that I've made that have done the best, like with Gratuitous Space Battles, it's a space strategy game where you have no control over the battle, which is immediately begs the question, how does that work? And then suddenly, like, you want to know. And with Democracy, it's a game. Firstly, it's a political strategy game, and there aren't many. There aren't hardly any. And secondly, it has no 3D world or no kind of representation at all. It doesn't really look like anything else. It looks kind of like, what on earth is this? So, like, a screenshot of it might seem strange, but it's interesting. And the kind of hook for Gratuitous Space Battles is that it is hands off. But you see so many indie games where people have basically played games they like and done one like a game that they like, and only with 1/100th of the budget. And it's just not going to sell. No amount of marketing and no amount of knowing the right people and no amount of PR is going to save them from the fact that it's just not an idea that is going to take off. It just, you know, unless you have like $200 million to kind of like ram another Space Marine first-person shooter.
Well,
because you can do it without.
Well, that's sort of the catch-22, right? So I can't say, oh, I'm making another StarCraft, or I'm making yet another Master of Orion that won't be Master of Orion, so nobody's going to like it. you know? So you can't say, well, I'm making a thing that's exactly like this other thing. And that's sort of the advice, though, that if you want to pitch a game, you have to say, well, my game is this, but with this. You know, so you have to have a direct comparison. You know, it's like, well, it's Space Invaders, but with, you know, dancing, right? I'll be right back. I have to go write that down. that's going to be something I'm going to pitch. But I have to have something that I can say, okay, this is like this game, but not because of this feature. But then again, if I had a game that's truly unique where I could say, you know, this game, I really can't say what to compare this to because this is something that's never really existed before, right? Like I've made something, but it's in space, right? You know, I run a taxi company on the moon. Oh well, you know what?
I nearly did that. I had a game. Yeah, man, I did a game. The second game I ever did was called Starlines Inc. And it got renamed to Starship Tycoon in the end. And it was basically run a space shipping company. And it's not particularly good. It's a 2D game. I don't think it's even on my website anymore. But I loved the idea. And I did go back to try and remake it. But I didn't really get into it. But I love the idea of you're basically running like a cruise line company, but in space, with like aliens that might all want different levels of gravity in their cabins and like space pirates. That would be great. Someone should do that. I'd buy it.
Yeah.
Well, I'd make it if I had like spare time.
So it's and you could get the dance element in there. It would be almost like Space Channel 5. Because have you ever played Space Channel 5?
Sure.
Yeah.
I've seen it played.
So but you could be like the cruise director. You could do the love boat in space, and I would be Isaac the bartender. Never mind. But anyway, yeah, so talking about like space shipping things, because I saw a thing that's on Steam, right? And it's called Transocean, and it's a shipping company simulator. And I look at this thing and I'm like, this is awesome. Why isn't this in space? Because it's really looking at their UI and everything that they're doing here, I kind of want to play this, but I would probably play it more if it was in space.
Yeah,
I think that's true of everything.
All this tycoon stuff.
Yes,
well,
exactly.
It is.
You're not wrong.
In fact, like the end of every sentence in a game pitch should be in space
with lasers.
With lasers.
Yeah, with lasers.
Well, I mean, like Red Shirt, the game that I published, was originally it was just like a social networking simulation thing. And a sort of game about, you know, kind of satirizing Facebook and everything. And like in discussions about it, it suddenly came out, you know, if this was like set on Deep Space Nine, that would be cool. So, you know, and then it suddenly became kind of slightly funnier and kind of like more interesting. Because you'd be having arguments with people who had tentacles. The gameplay is
interesting, but I find that the sense of humor about it, because it is set in space and it's all the in-jokes about, you know, space show tropes and whatnot, that actually draws me to it far more than the core gameplay. If the core gameplay was like, oh, I'm a 16-year-old girl trying to manage, you know, all my Facebook friends, I'd be like, oh, God. You know, but since it's like, oh no, well I'm a three-eyed alien, you know, and I'm trying to get from my janitor job up to being like the head of engineering. Oh well, now that's my game. So
see, I quite like that. I mean, because Mitu's British as well, and we have it's kind of a British sense of humor that have you ever seen they tried to remake it a series called Red Dwarf.
Oh, yeah, sure, of course.
Yeah, basically, if it's British,
like BBC America,
Americans probably like British stuff more than British people do. So,
well, we would assume like Red Dwarf wouldn't work.
Yeah, have you heard of Doctor Who? I don't know if you guys have that over there. I think they actually just make it for the American audience.
I can't believe Missy is. Oh wait, I'll be quiet.
But what amazes me about like kind of Red Dwarf even vaguely being popular in the States is it's a very British theme in that the heroes are complete losers who are kind of like their ambition is to kind of like, you know, have a curry or something or to fix the vending machine. That's very British.
Well, the thing about America is
that's true. Like the young ones
in the young ones.
Yeah.
Wow. You took me back.
The IT crowd, really. Black books. All about losers, really. I never even thought of that.
Well, the thing is, American comedy's not funny. That's the problem.
It can be.
Well,
but
we have some standout things, but if you look at stuff like Parks and Recreation, that's pretty much a British show set in America. I mean, when I look at it,
it's kind of a copy of The Office, which was a British.
Right. And what is Parks and Recreation? It's a room full of losers. Right. So
that's not a bad point.
Yeah. And even Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is kind of, you know, it's that kind of weird. I mean, it starts with someone's home being demolished for bureaucratic reasons, which is so British. It's so kind of like,
is that really super British?
Oh yeah, like due to some ridiculous planning bureaucracy nonsense, like, you know, your whole planet is being destroyed. That's so English. And the fact that we wouldn't even complain and just go, oh well, if they've got the right paperwork, then, you know, I guess there's nothing we can do. I went to
find them thing. It was down in the basement behind a crocodile.
Yeah, that is so. As someone who lives in a listed house, which kind of means it's got a lot of planning restrictions, I can assure you that is England all over.
So let me ask you one question. One of my favorite movies is Hot Fuzz.
Oh, man, yeah.
Did they capture the feel of the British village pretty well?
I live there. I really. That whole thing of like the greater good, you know, yeah. And I'm pretty sure that our unkept hedge is what made this village not win the village of the year. No, it's taken seriously. I'm not kidding. It really is taken seriously.
You know, one of my favorite British shows, I just had to ask my wife the name of it, though, because I couldn't remember. But I love the show, is Doc Martin. I don't know if you've seen it.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, because it's like a little British fishing town, and this guy moves in as the town doctor. And it's just a show about all the crazy bullshit that happens in this little one-horse town. And it's great.
That's similar to my girlfriend's favorite British show, which is Father Ted.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a little more Irish, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Don't get confused.
Do you know they have television in Canada? I had no idea. Then I saw this show. It was called Da Vinci's Inquest. And it's he's like a coroner or something in Canada. Or medical examiner guy, right? And it's almost like, do you remember Quincy from when we were kids? Yeah. So it's like Quincy in Canada, you know, but it's very uniquely low key, you know. It's not a lot of gunfights, and you know, it's definitely not American.
It's Canada.
It is.
Actually, talking of shows like that, what I cannot understand as an English person is how Hugh Laurie is considered firstly to be a heartthrob, but secondly to be like a very convincing American accent, apparently.
It is.
Because it's convincing enough because there's so much of a melting pot over here that you can have an accent. You can like be from somewhere but have you lived enough other places maybe that you've picked up other accents.
Well, I had no idea. I thought he was American, and then whenever I saw Gloria and heard his real voice, I was just like, "Oh my god."
Oh no, I was the opposite.
Yeah.
I saw him on Blackadder before I ever saw him on House, and then I see him on House, I'm like, what the hell happened to his voice?
Oh, wow.
We find it so
he doesn't
weird.
Sound like him at all.
Hey, and speaking of Fry, I would pay real money if we could get a clone of QI on American TV. Although
I've never seen QI, but I keep hearing about it.
Just go on YouTube. It's all on YouTube. It's just hilarious. It's basically just a bunch of comedians sitting having a panel show where they try to talk about real issues but end up just killing each other.
It is pretty good, but it's repeated on TV so often here that we just don't even notice if there's a new series. It's just like always on. It's on all the time, so it gets a little bit irritating. But yeah, it's pretty good.
It would be like if we took Jeopardy and all the contestants were comedians and they were just allowed to ramble the whole show.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
it's good stuff. Good stuff.
Well, guys, I hate to cut this short, but I have to vote and get to work.
Yeah, go vote. Vote for democracy.
I'm going to
vote
for
democracy 3 because.
But Cliff, I want to thank you for coming on talking about GSB 1 and 2. When will GSB 2 be ready for public consumption?
Oh God! Well, this is a big question. I did this show and people kept asking when, and I was saying, oh, it'll probably be in beta in kind of November, December, and then it'll be out in January or February, and that's clearly nonsense. It'll probably be because I got a bit carried away on like just really getting into it. So it'll probably be more like it'll be in beta in sort of January, February.
Because I felt bad when I asked you if we can have a build to stream. I could feel your nervousness over the email. Like, well, oh God, please, no.
I mean, there is a build. There is a build. It is ridiculous because I can't convey how like surrounded by like sheep and stuff I am where I live. The internet is not good, and it's not a big game. It's probably about 600 meg to upload, but that's like a day for me.
So you actually have loose geese on the run, loose swans on the run that the cops are chasing.
we don't, but we do have deer. Sometimes we find deer in our garden, but not swans.
Have you ever seen that?
Yeah,
have you ever seen that movie Black Sheep?
What's that?
There is a movie called Black Sheep. It was about were sheep.
Was that with?
We're close enough to Halloween that I think that you should seek it out.
Is that with Chris Fair? No, what the hell is his name?
Oh, I have no idea who's in it. It's not really a comedy, but it is.
David Spade and Chris.
Oh no! This is a legit horror movie.
Oh, so another black sheep. I was thinking the David Spade, Chris.
Oh, yeah, no. Chris Farley. No.
Farley, thank you.
Oh, no. This is a legitimate, like, gory horror movie.
Oh, no.
About were-sheep. But then you think about it, and it's like, oh, my God, it's were-sheep. And they're looking out the window, and there's, like, a flock of sheep coming down the hill, and they're, like, boarding up the door.
Oh, God.
take a zombie movie, replace the zombies with sheep.
Okay, I might be able to watch that because zombies scare the fuck out of me.
That should be a game rather than another zombie game. It's like, yeah, it's another zombie game, but it's sheep zombies.
No, I saw somebody made a mod.
I would play that. I would play that.
Somebody made a mod for Arma 3, and it's Sheep Island.
Oh, really?
And it's zombie sheep on the thing. Yeah. I'll give you a link to it. Robaz, Robbaz, R O B B A Z. He's the king of Sweden. And he he did a Let's Play of it, and it's just fabulous.
Oh, that sounds amazing. So, all right, we're going to wrap this up again. But, Cliff, thank you so much for coming on. Can't wait to see GSP2. GSP1 still kicks my ass. It's very compelling. It's just you can only lose so often without starting to feel inadequate and starting to question your own life. So I can only play this so much before I start to really get depressed. Like, why am I so horrible?
You need to make a game called, like, Spaceship Therapy or something.
Yeah.
For Brian. It'll be Starship Therapy.
Tell me about your mother. Yeah. anyway, I'm about to cut the stream, but thank you so much, everyone who's watching, and have a great day.
In space, with lasers.
And again, if you have a request for a topic or a guest, don't forget you can hit us up at hail@spacegamejunkie.com. And please like us on iTunes and all that fun stuff. Thank you, guys. Bye.
In space with lasers.